Russia fires missiles off its east coast.
Russia's defense ministry says Moscow has test-fired anti-ship missiles in the Sea of Japan.
Plus, an overnight drone attack on Kyiv.
What's probably the most important about this attack, that a couple of explosions were heard in the city of Kyiv. The debris of one of the drones hit a store.
And later in the program, we hear from a prominent Belarusian opposition leader who was recently tried in absentia and sentenced to 15 years behind bars. Today is Tuesday, March 28th. From the Voice of America in Washington, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish. Thousands of kilometers to the east of the front lines in the war with Ukraine, Russia is involved in a much older, though much quieter, conflict with Japan. The two countries each claim a few small islands off Japan's northern coast. They've disagreed about these islands since the end of World War II, but after Russia's invasion of Ukraine, things got more tense. Japan joined much of the world in sanctioning Russia and supporting Ukraine, and Prime Minister Fumio Kishida recently visited Kyiv. Now, Russia is testing missiles in the Sea of Japan. Lisa Dwyer reports.
Russia's defense ministry says Moscow has test-fired anti-ship missiles in the Sea of Japan. The ministry says two boats launched a simulated missile attack on a mock enemy warship about 60 miles away. The ministry says the target was successfully hit by two cruise missiles, whose NATO reporting name is the SSN-22 Sunburn, which is a supersonic anti-ship cruise missile that has conventional and nuclear warhead capacity. Russia says the exercise took place in the Peter of the Great Bay in the Sea of Japan. I'm Lisa Dwyer.
There's an office building in Moscow with a 17-story high advertisement for the Wagner Group on its side. The Wagner Group is a private military company. Its soldiers are fighting alongside Russian army soldiers in some of the fiercest battles in Ukraine. The advertisement is for recruiting mercenaries to join the fight. Reuters' Lucy Fielder has more.
A giant recruitment ad for Russia's Wagner mercenary force has appeared on the facade of an office block in northeast Moscow. Wagner is thought to have sustained heavy losses in the eastern Ukrainian city of Bakhmut, the longest, bloodiest battle of the war so far. It fights alongside Russian forces in the region and has sought to replenish troop numbers ahead of a potential Ukrainian counteroffensive. 17 stories high, the ad shows the group's logo and the slogans, "Join the winning team" and "Together we will win." Wagner boss Yevgeny Prigozhin said earlier this month that he aimed to recruit 30,000 new fighters by mid-May. Ukrainian and Western officials say Wagner is sending poorly prepared fighters to certain death. For months, Wagner has spearheaded Russia's push to take the small city of Bakhmut, which is now in ruins. Both sides have referred to Bakhmut as a meat grinder. Prigozhin has said his men's task there is to bleed the Ukrainian army dry.
That's Reuters' Lucy Fielder reporting. Lots going on in Kyiv today. An overnight drone attack and a change in control for Ukraine's most significant religious site. Anna Chernikova has the latest.
Another drone attack over the night in Kyiv and some other areas of Ukraine, particularly central part and eastern part. I can say that General Staff of Ukraine confirmed that 14 drones out of 15 were shut down by Ukrainian Air Force, air defense. What's probably the most important about this attack, that a couple of explosions were heard in the city of Kyiv. The debris of one of the drones hit a store area of around 200 square meters. It was quite a big fire in there, but it took Kyiv rescue services a couple of hours to localize the fire and to stop it. According to the mayor of Kyiv, no casualties were reported.
And in other military news, Anna, it seems like Ukraine is receiving some deliveries lately. Can you tell us what's been arriving?
Yes, actually, we're getting more and more reports about the tanks and aircrafts coming to Ukraine. And we've heard already a couple of weeks ago from different countries that those tanks which are coming to Ukraine under this so-called tank coalition started to arrive. And Ukrainian Ministry of Defense also confirmed that. Today, it was another confirmation from the Ministry of Defense of Portugal that actually their tank, Leopard tanks, have already arrived to Ukraine as well. And basically, well, this is, of course, for Ukraine is a great sign, because we all are hearing from different Ukrainian officials and President Zelensky himself that sooner the all the equipment arrive, then sooner Ukraine can start the counter-offensive.
And changing gears now from the military conflict to a conflict of another sort, one of the most famous churches in Ukraine, probably the most famous church, the Lavra in Kyiv. There's some controversy there. Can you tell us what's going on?
It's a so-called, you know, cultural conflict, if we can put it this way, religious conflict inside Ukraine that lasts for a lot of years, actually, but particularly it is important now when a full-scale invasion started, because so in Ukraine there is this controversy around churches, and there is Ukrainian church and another Ukrainian church which is under Russian influence, because this Ukrainian church has its basically has its central in Russia, so it's a so-called Russian church representation in Ukraine. And a lot of Ukrainians, of course, especially after the beginning of the full-scale invasion, do not want Russian church in Ukraine or so-called Ukrainian church under Russian control to operate and to be present in the country. And for many years, for decades actually, this church had control and had premises in use of this Lavra in Kyiv, one of the most important monastery for Orthodox religion in general. And this year, it was already announced previously, and we had reports on that, for the Christmas service, Ukrainian church actually officially got access to Lavra, to one part of Lavra, because Lavra complex is huge, and it consists of two parts, Lower Lavra and Upper Lavra. So Upper Lavra was already provided to Ukrainian church, and today is the last day when Ukrainian church under Russian control can use the lower part of Lavra. Tomorrow is the day when they have to leave. Of course, it's quite a big conflict inside, because representatives of the church do not want to leave. However, we can already see them leaving. But it looks like that actually, it looks like not only, you know, political decision, but also a social decision, that Ukrainians don't want to see Russian church representatives in Ukraine, and it looks like that this church will be passing to the Ukrainian church control sometime soon.
And we'll certainly stay tuned for more updates from you as that story evolves. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. Anna, as always, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Karish. Russia's ally and Ukraine's neighbor to the north, Belarus, has been in the news a lot lately. Russian President Vladimir Putin said that he'll put tactical nuclear weapons there. And earlier this month, the exiled opposition leader, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, was sentenced to 15 years in prison after trial in absentia on charges including conspiring to overthrow the government. It was the latest move in a months-long effort by the Belarusian government to suppress dissent. Now, Tikhanovskaya, who was in Washington, D.C., leading a delegation of the Belarusian opposition, visited the VOA studios and answered questions about the democratic movement in Belarus. She spoke with VOA Russian Service's Alice Krugliov.
Just over a year ago, the world expressed its support and solidarity with Belarusians who fought for their freedom, and just couple years later, now many people called us a Belarus a co-aggressor. Do you think it complicates lives of ordinary people and you as a national leader?
So it took us a while after the beginning of the war to explain to the world that Belarusian people and Belarusian regime is absolutely two different things. That Belarusian regime became accomplice in this war, and all those who are responsible have to bear responsibility for this. And Belarusian people who are opposing this war, who are on the side of Ukraine, and it's necessary to create as much pressure as possible on the regime, political pressure, economical pressure, but support people in their fight. Our nation, our people, despite of the huge level of repressions inside the country, try to support Ukrainians as much as we can. We saw acts of sabotage of our partisans on railways, blowing up of Russian civilians' airplane, acts of disobedience, putting Ukrainian flags in Belarus. It's all cost a lot. People are being detained every day in Belarus for their anti-regime position and for their anti-war position. But the participation of regime in this war doesn't make our nation collaborants or participants. And it's also very important to distinguish Belarusian people from Russians, because in Belarus, 86% of Belarusians are against participation of Belarus in the war, and you will never see this Z or V signs on our streets. We consider Ukrainians as our close nation, and we are facing actually the same enemy, imperialistic ambitions of Russia, and we have to fight together.
You called Lukashenko as a puppet of Putin. How does it affect future policies of Belarus? Is the very independence of country at stake now?
We are fighting for freedom, sovereignty, independence of Belarus. Belarusian people have made their choice back in 2020. We are against the regime, and now, after the beginning of the war, this geopolitical choice of Belarusians became evident. Belarusians feel themselves as part of European family of countries, and we now Russia is connected with war and poverty, while West is peace and security. And people want our beloved Belarus to be prosperous, safe country, a good ally and partner for our neighbors. And this is what we are fighting for. So, you know, Belarusians don't see their future with the imperialistic Russia. I think that all the deals that are made between Lukashenko and Putin for these 2 years shouldn't be recognized as legitimate and should be overlooked. So there is no future of, I suppose, of any democratic and free country with such Russia.
What is the possibility of Belarus entering full-scale war with Ukraine in the future?
So here again, we have to distinguish Belarusian regime and Belarus as it is. Belarusian regime has already become full accomplice in this war. They provided, Lukashenko and his cronies provided our territory, our infrastructure for Russian army to attack Ukraine, and they have to bring to accountability for this. A special tribunal have to be opened against Lukashenko and all those who have been participating. Lukashenko has to be recognized as sponsor of terrorism. But Belarusian people, Belarusian army is against this war. And if at the beginning of the war it would be more possibilities for Belarusian army to participate because of, you know, huge tensions in the region, now it became evident that Belarusian soldiers don't want to fight with Ukrainians. They don't want to kill or to be killed for Lukashenko and for Putin. So I see this scenario of participation of Belarusian army as minimal, but again, Belarusian land can be used at any moment for launching missiles, for attacking Ukraine again. And this is Lukashenko who has to be responsible for this.
Elez Krugliakov of VOA's Russian service, speaking with Belarusian opposition leader Svetlana Tikhanovskaya. At an event Monday night in Washington, D.C., Beth Van Schaack, the U.S. Ambassador at Large for Global Criminal Justice, announced that the U.S. will support the development of a dedicated tribunal to prosecute the crime of aggression against Ukraine. It's a story Alexei Kovalenko of VOA's Ukrainian service has been following for a long time, and he was there last night.
Yes, indeed. We've heard from Beth Van Schaack that United States supports the development of internationalized tribunal that would be dedicated to prosecuting the crime of aggression against Ukraine. She also said that there were a number of models that were under U.S. consideration, and all of them were analyzed closely, and U.S. chose to support exactly this internationalized court that would be rooted in Ukraine's judicial system, quote.
And if this were to go forward, if there was to be a prosecution, who would be put on trial?
So this is the tribunal to prosecute the leadership of Russia for the crime of aggression.
So this isn't the individual war crimes, the torture, the killing of civilians. This is the overarching aggression that led to the war. What's the difference?
Yes, exactly. So there are multiple cases of war crimes that are right now under investigation. And Ukraine Prosecutor General reported that it's more than 70,000 cases. And we know from recent International Criminal Court announcement that they investigate their cases and they issued arrest warrant for the specific case of the children deportation to Russia. But this is a tribunal specifically to investigate and prosecute the main and overarching crime of aggression.
And when can we expect hearings to begin? What's the next step?
In fact, I asked the question whether there is consensus about the specific model that U.S. and West and Ukraine would agree on. So right now, there is no such model, and this is a model that U.S. supports. And there are a couple models that are still on the table. So countries, U.S. partners, and Ukraine are still looking for a consensus, one model that everyone would agree on that can be created to start investigation and prosecution of Russia's aggression against Ukraine.
Alexei Kovalenko with VOA's Ukrainian service. Alexei, thanks again for your time. Thanks for keeping us updated on the story.
Thank you.
Since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the Russian police have escalated the use of facial recognition software to crack down on dissidents and to prevent people from protesting. Reuters' Lucy Ha has more.
This video was recorded by Russian civil rights activist Alexander Zharov as he entered a metro station in Moscow. We see Zharov walking through a payment gate equipped with a camera, which snaps a photo of him. Minutes later, police officers approach him on the platform. It was the third time Zharov had been detained inside the Moscow metro.
I asked them to tell me the reason for my detention. One of the police officers justified this by saying that I was on the wanted list.
The 32-year-old was identified by facial recognition, a technology that's widely deployed across the city's subway system. A Reuters investigation has found that Moscow's video surveillance network plays an important role in the arrests of anti-government protesters. We also found that since Russia invaded Ukraine in February 2022, authorities have begun using facial recognition as a preventive measure to stop people from protesting in the first place.
In Russia, we have a big brother who's watching for you every time, and people can talk more about political things.
The Russian government and Moscow city authorities did not respond to detailed questions for this story and the episodes it describes. Let's take a closer look at how facial recognition is helping Russian police identify and sweep up Kremlin's opponents whenever they choose. In 2017, the city of Moscow announced the launch of one of the world's largest facial recognition video surveillance networks. Some 160,000 cameras were installed across the city to help law enforcement, the city's Department of Information Technology said at the time. The Moscow Metro uses facial recognition as part of its fare payment system, as well as for security reasons. Passengers are photographed as they walk through the gates. a computer algorithm that uses artificial intelligence to analyze and identify faces. If the system flags a passenger for detention, police responds within seconds or minutes. That's according to 29 people who were detained in this way. All have one thing in common. They're critical of President Vladimir Putin. Most have previously joined anti-government protests.
I think the reason why I was detained in the metro is due to me taking my civic stance, which is that I'm against the war between Russia and Ukraine and against political repression in the country.
Our review of more than 2,000 court cases shows that these cameras have played an important role in the arrests of hundreds of protesters. Most of these people were detained in 2021 after they joined anti-government demonstrations. But after Russia invaded Ukraine, authorities began using facial recognition to prevent people from protesting in the first place. That's according to more than 24 detainees. 27-year-old Sergei Pinchuk is one of them.
On May 9th, I was detained in the metro. I had been detained before 5 or 6 times, I don't remember, because of my political activities. But that detention, it was special, it was unusual, because I was detained for nothing. Just when I entered to the metro station, a police officer approached to me, grabbed me and said, "You're detained, come with me."
Pinchuk says the police then took him to a nearby police station for interrogation.
There was a police officer, Rogov, it's his last name. I remember that because he threatened me. He said that he put me in a prison for years. He grabbed my neck and beat me against the wall a couple of times, kicked by his foot. And he was really angry, he was violent. Yeah, that was bad experience.
Neither Pinchuk nor Zharov were charged with any offense. Russian and Moscow officials did not respond to Reuters questions about the detention of Zharov, Pinchuk, or the other interviewees. The Kremlin referred detailed questions for this story to the Moscow mayor's office, which did not respond. And Russia's interior ministry, which oversees law enforcement, didn't respond to questions sent via the Kremlin. For both Pinchuk and Zharov, the surveillance, risk of detention, coupled with pressure from the police, have so upended their lives, they felt they were left with no other choice but to leave Russia.
After the detention, I had a feeling that Russia was transforming into some sort of a Chinese Xinjiang filial branch, where modern digital technologies became toy in the hands of a dictator.
Zharov has moved to Germany, while Pinchuk decided to relocate to the United States. He now lives in Seattle and is seeking asylum.
It all happened so fast. I didn't even regret in that moment, in that day. But then I realized that I left all my life here, my dog, my parents, my friends, you know. When I get in a car and go to the airport, yeah, I was crying a little bit there.
That was Reuters' Lucy Ha with that story. And that'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day. Visit us online at voanews.com and on social media. Be sure to follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.